Happy Earth Day to everyone. Thanks for coming out this morning. This is, besides just being Earth Day, I think it's a great timing on having Sylvia over to talk with us today about the future of oceans and food security. In part due to, of course, the great attention being placed on food security and what it means to the planet's resources. This is the most recent National Geographic magazine issue. It's one of, I believe, seven forthcoming issues that will focus on food security, and I'm sure they'll have quite a lot on oceans as well. But I think one of the important things about the cover of this, and it's an issue that I hope we all keep in mind as we discuss this, says serving more than 7 billion every day. And I like the fact that they put on there every day, because a lot of times when we talk about food security, we talk about our need to feed 9 billion in 40 years, or now it's 35 years, it keeps shrinking. But, you know, it's as if, it sort of paints a picture as if 9 billion people are going to show up, we feed them, and then they go home, and that's over. But the you know, if we look back at the past 40 years, the negative impacts of food production and consumption are cumulative. They just keep piling up. The greatest damage to resources due to agriculture have, of course, come in those 40 years, and it's been tremendous. If you look at the graphs, it's just bad lines all across the board. Now, of course, we don't want to get sunk on this beautiful Earth Day into all the negative, because there are a lot of positive trends as well, and we'll be covering those too. Some of the most troubling trends, though, I believe, have come from the oceans, where our collective attention just has not been focused on the oceans, in part, of course, I believe, because we don't see below much of the ocean. So that's why it's just tremendous to have Sylvia here. She's our eyes and ears below the waters. And, you know, there's a whole list of accomplishments that Sylvia has achieved over the years, being a pioneer in ocean exploration, ocean development, ocean conservation, and bringing a whole new generation with each new accomplishment into appreciating the wonders of the ocean. You know, I could go on and on. My kids would just say, well, what more is there to say for somebody that has a Lego action figure made after him? I mean, that's pretty much all you really need to say. She is an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. There's not many of those. And she's created, developed, expanded several nonprofit organizations. Many of these are heavily linked to the private sector. She's made some of the most interesting partnerships with the private sector. I just recently, I think it was 2 months ago, I saw Sylvia on a Land Rover commercial. Land Rover going under sea with, you know, with Sylvia there pulling them under the water. But you'll see on her biography, you know, there's great biographies of her all over about all the many awards, the records that she's broken by going underwater, how the depths, the durations. And she was there early on, so a real pioneer in many different ways. And I've been on panels with Sylvia several times, and we do disagree on some things. Namely, I think it's all about soil. She thinks it's all about water. But I guess in the spirit of Earth Day, today we'll agree it's about both. So without going through her long, extended list of accomplishments, I'd just like to introduce Dr. Sylvia Earle. Thank you, Sylvia, for coming.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, National Geographic, for getting us together in the first place and for really focusing on this critical issue of how are we going to sustain ourselves, feed ourselves, and otherwise keep ourselves alive from this point onward. We've been able to succeed and have such great prosperity over the years that humans have been around by consuming the planet, one way or the other. But there is a point beyond which, you know, things begin to unravel, and we are there. We are there. And the curious thing is, we are perhaps the only creature who's ever lived on Earth with the capacity to understand that we are there. We are at a critical point in understanding that the very systems that keep us alive, the air we breathe, the water we drink, of course the food, all of it, a planet that has a certain temperature range, and all the other things that we have heretofore pretty much taken for granted. Now we know there are limits. Birds don't know that. Elephants, as smart as they are, haven't been able to dive back into the past or anticipate the future. They don't have computers to crunch the numbers. They don't have the capacity to store and draw upon knowledge as humans have done over the ages. When I was about 5 years old, it occurred to me that there was a lot I didn't know. Because that's when I started school. And it was kind of overwhelming, the thought that I had to somehow stuff my brain with the knowledge that had been accumulated before my time. I had to learn how to read, to write, to deal with numbers. But nowhere in my education did I learn about where air comes from. Not until far along in my education, if you will. And it actually didn't come in school. It came from reading. It came from asking questions, doing what little kids tend to do. I just never stopped. You know, who, what, why, where, when, how, why. That's what kids do, and that's what all of us should do. We should never quite grow up in terms of that attitude. And we should never lose that sense of, oh, there's so much to learn. How am I ever going to master the basics? Well, that was many decades ago. And what I find is there's even more to learn today than there was then. We've learned more, actually, in the last half century. Certainly about the ocean, but more about ourselves, more about the diversity of life, more about our place in the universe, how extraordinary it is that Earth exists at all, or that life exists, or that we exist. So, we're going to get around to the ocean and food security, but I want to do this by putting it in perspective, to realize life is a miracle. We're a miracle. For most of Earth history, there were no humans. There are a lot of other critters that are still with us, upon whom we totally dependent for things we care about, like breathing, like a planet that works in our favor, planetary chemistry that has taken basically all preceding history to get to the point where we can breathe, where oxygen is about 20% of the atmosphere. And it continues to be replenished every day by green things on the dirt, the land, but also in the ocean. Somewhat more in the ocean, it turns out, than on the land. And it's replenished very quickly in the ocean because the green things, blue-green things, the photosynthesizers in the sea tend to be small and have a short, fast, productive life history that not only generates oxygen but generates food, fixes carbon dioxide, makes the planet run the way it does. Well, now we know what we couldn't know when AID was started in 1961, this view of Earth did not exist. When I was a kid, this view of Earth didn't exist. I saw Earth as a globe, and the ocean was a big blob of blue. Now we have a capacity, and it is still imperfect by a lot. If you've been following the news about what happened to the Malaysian aircraft, what's it like in the depths of the southern Indian Ocean? We don't know. We don't have a map as good for the ocean in that part of the world or in most of the world as we do for the moon or Mars or Jupiter. We've invested in exploring the skies above, and it really has paid off handsomely, and we've neglected the ocean, the blue part of the planet. Why? Well, perhaps it's because we are terrestrial by nature. You know, it's just we're air breathers. Most of life on Earth lives in the water. Most of life, in terms of sheer quantity and certainly in terms of diversity. Fresh water, of course, but that's only like 3% of the water on Earth. 97% is the ocean. All life requires water. Dirt helps. We need to anchor. Yeah. But as I sometimes say, no blue, no green. You have to start with the water. All life requires water. Most of things on the land also require soil. And it's just great that we have a planet like this that works in our favor, at least so far. But you can imagine, take away the ocean, take away the water. We've got our lots of options out there in the universe, including our sister planet Mars. And there is water there. And apparently it used to be a lot of water. We've managed to somehow retain liquid water at just the right temperature within the range that the processes have developed over the ages to make life possible, makes our life possible. Yet, some of my pals at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution have calculated just how much water there is. And if you take it all, the clouds, the water that's in all of us, and all the rest of life on Earth, I mean, we're mostly water, too. You know, take all the ocean, all the frozen water, and you put it in a ball. That's about all there is. Spread it out over the surface of the world. The average depth is 2.5 miles. It's about where that Malaysian aircraft is thought to be, 2.5 miles beneath the surface. And the maximum, 7 miles. 7 miles. A few places. It's about something between 2 and 3% of the ocean that is below 6,000 meters. It's kind of below half the ocean's depth. But the average depth is 4,000 meters. So it gives you an idea of how much water there is. If you spread it out, it looks like a lot. But if you ball it up, that's it. That's where everything that we care about, it's where our existence really is anchored, in that blue part. And we have historically taken it for granted. We take climate and weather more or less for granted, although, you know, that is changing. Well, climate is changing, weather is changing, and our views are beginning to change. We are beginning to understand that we have the power to alter the nature of nature, alter the processes that underpin our security. We talk about food security, but food security has to be anchored in a planet that works. You have to be able to breathe. You have to have a temperature range that is suitable for us. And to recognize this is not just a physical process, this is a biological process. Earth has been shaped to be what it is because largely microbes, those little guys that were just beginning to understand matter in our own bodies, in the soil, in the air, in the ocean, where most of the action actually is. We are just like 5-year-olds in a way, beginning to understand the magnitude of our ignorance and the risks that we are imposing on our life support system. Food security is like level 2. First, you have to have a planet that can give us the ingredients so that we can eat and breathe and live. And much of what we now know has come about because we have harnessed fossil fuels so that we can go high in the sky, so that we can see ourselves with new eyes, the way no bird, no bacterium, no fish can know what humans know. And never before could we know what we now know. And it's getting better all the time. But there is a point where we can have those aha moments and pull back and say, wow, by connecting knowledge gained somewhere in Africa with somewhere in Asia, with North America and Europe and Australia and wherever, now we are beginning to see the pieces of the puzzle come together, drawing back through all of human time to the present time. We're connected and can see what we couldn't see before. There has always been a tendency. It's true in business, it's true in sometimes families, you tend to get siloed. You get focused on your special area of interest and are not as receptive to understanding what others are thinking or doing or learning that might benefit you. But that is changing. Knowing that kids run around with a Library of Congress in their pockets, or at least access to it, they have Google Earth, the dirt, but they also have the ocean. You can find yourself, you can find your neighbors, you can see yourself in perspective in ways impossible to contemplate, not only when I was a kid, but when today's kids were kids. You know, 10 years ago, what did we know as compared to what we now know? But the policies that we have that guide our existence, the laws that we've set in place, take longer to shift, to respond to the new knowledge that we have. Now we can see that not only are we connected, but the world is connected, that what is dumped in the ocean off the coast of Africa or Japan or wherever ultimately affects everybody. What we put into the atmosphere ultimately affects everybody. Here you see sands of Africa blowing across the Atlantic. Well, they're dusting Washington, D.C., oh, by the way, and they continue across and darken the snows of Colorado and land in the Pacific. Some of it may even circle all the way around and wind up back in Africa. We're connected. And I think it's just the greatest time to be alive ever. That knowledge that now we can see where storms come from. Our ancestors, they had almanacs maybe 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, to kind of project the future, but now we know we can do a lot better than that. Now we can measure things in ways we couldn't measure before. We can measure the changes in the atmosphere, the changes in the ice. We can see the changes even in places that we're just beginning to explore. The figures on coral reefs are that from about 50 years ago to the present time, about half the coral reefs are either gone or they're in a state of sharp decline. In the Caribbean, it's more like 80%. Some places are in better shape, parts of the Pacific, where they're 80% in good health. But nowhere are coral reefs as pristine as they were 50 years ago, for many reasons. Part of it is the changes in temperature. Part of it is our appetite for the creatures that live in coral reefs. Gradual understanding that coral reefs are not just about the corals. They're systems like Washington, D.C., or New York, or Sydney, or London. You need the garbage collectors, you need the taxi drivers, you need this, you need that. It's not just about the buildings. Coral reefs are not just about the buildings. And we have depleted many of the aspects of coral reefs and other systems that cause them to function properly. And we are seeing a meltdown of places like kelp forests, of systems that once we could, or thought we could, take for granted. It's not just what we're taking out of the ocean. Of course, it's what we're putting in. Maybe the most important thing that we're putting in, and it's a headliner today, plastics, as bad as they are not as worrisome as excess carbon dioxide that is not only driving climate change, global warming, and other, you know, sea level rise, things that people do worry about, but acidification of the ocean is now a headline. I participated in a call yesterday that is a planning call for the U.S. State Department's conference on the ocean. It will take place in June of this year. And there are three topics of great concern. One of them is overfishing. Another has to do with pollution. But the third big headliner is ocean acidification. Ocean acidification. Change the chemistry of the ocean, you change everything. It isn't just about diminishing shells of oysters or loss of coral reefs, another pressure on top of the others. But what about coccolithophorids and other photosynthesizers that have a calcium carbonate shell, or even the backbones of fish that as larvae may be susceptible to the formation of that critical backbone in a more acidic environment? Lots of questions. We're just beginning to get some answers. At the same time, the concerns about other things that we're putting into the ocean, plastics that don't go away, that did not exist when AID came into existence in 1961. How many Ziploc bags existed then? None. There were some plastics, but no water was available in plastic bottles in 1961, or even in 1971 or 1981. It's taken a while for us to get that notion that carrying water in a plastic bottle for one-time use and then tossing it was a good idea. Not a good idea. One-time use plastics, we're now beginning to see, not a good idea. But the policies haven't caught up with what we now know. We've got to get better at responding to what we know as we understand that we are at critical points. What we're putting into the ocean, whether it's excess nitrates and phosphates and things that flow from the land through rivers and into the groundwater, or through what we deliberately put into the ocean. I'm reading a book now about getting trapped under the sea, the story of brave guys who actually made it possible to relocate Boston's sewage 10 miles offshore through pipes. It used to be dumped right there in Boston Harbor when I lived in Boston in the 1960s. You know, there's a nice gooey sludge on the bottom of Boston Harbor. Not a good place that I wanted to dive. Not a good place. I released some lobsters there, and I wished them well because I probably didn't do them a favor by turning them loose in Boston Harbor. But, you know, now Boston Harbor has improved because we've relocated the sludge and all that sewage. It hasn't gone away. It still exists. Everything connects. We've just distributed it more widely, affected more of the ocean in ways that we're beginning now to measure. There's got to be a better way of dealing with the wastes that we generate and turn them into something positive. We're so concerned about losing nitrates and phosphates, and yet, you know, we're making it happen in part through our policies. So, you know better than most, because you do track numbers. You are interested in security, food security. How do we get from where we are to a better place? How do you do it on the back of knowing that the systems that we now look to produce even more than they have in the past, when already they are shockingly depleted? Wildlife from the sea. This image, well, it is just, you know, you can't take it literally, but you can take it as a suggestion of, there were a lot of fish back when my father was born in 1900. 100 years later, there aren't so many. We've seen a sharp decline, and it isn't just in the North Atlantic. It is globally. We have seen a reduction in ocean wildlife. And there's a pattern here. Ed Wilson speaks of how on the land over 10,000 years, Ed Wilson, Harvard ant-man, biologist, big thinker, commented that we consumed the large, the slow, and the tasty wild animals on the land. We did. We did in over 10,000 years. A lot of things magically disappeared. The big wildlife, North America, but also Australia, everywhere that humans arrived, Madagascar, New Zealand, Easter Island. We consumed our way into some level of prosperity. And then in order to feed ourselves, what did we do? We had to cultivate. How could we possibly have 7 billion people if we depended on wild birds or wild animals? How far would that take us? Songbirds, they're already greatly depleted, even though we don't tend to eat very many of them. Or even the so-called game birds that are plant eaters and generally do reproduce fairly quickly. But we look at the level of ducks today. We can still take a few home once in a while for dinner, wild ducks, wild turkeys, but only because we realize if we are to have them to take home for dinner once in a while, you have to protect breeding areas, you have to protect feeding areas. You can't take them anywhere, anytime, in any numbers. And they're not free. Well, with fish, we haven't quite figured that out. The accounting base for fish swimming in the ocean is zero. go figure. We don't put into our books thinking about real estate, the ocean is free, open, you know, whether it's aquaculture or catching wild things. You know, it's really tempting to say, oh, the ocean, it's free. You can go and take, or you can put pens out into the ocean. And the tax base there is pretty attractive as compared to a piece of land. And the water, it's there, it's free. You don't have to think about where it comes from, because it's always been there, the idea, it will always be there. And we have to think again about that. Fish should not be regarded as free goods. And if they are, then who gives fishermen a special right to take from what, if it belongs to anybody, it belongs to all of us. I want my share, if there is such a thing, to be alive. Who says that the only value of fish is to kill them for food? Aren't there some other values that we should be looking at, whether you care about coral reefs or care about the integrity of ocean systems and how they function? It's like birds. People used to think birds were primarily something to eat, and some people still do. And we do eat a lot of birds, Kentucky fried birds and, you know, Christmas birds and whatever. You know, we eat a lot of birds, but most of them we don't. And particularly we don't eat eagles and owls and top predators or birds that live a long time. It take a long time to mature. We used to. Everything used to be fair game 10,000 years ago, or even 5,000, even 1,000, even now in some parts of the world. If it's edible, it's fair game. But only now, with our perspective that is drawn from all preceding history, are we beginning to understand that we are really making inroads into our life support system. The chemistry of the ocean has to be influenced when you take whatever it is. Is it 80 million? Is it 100 million? Is it 110 million tons of ocean wildlife out of the system every year? Relocate those elements of food chains, of nutrient cycles. When a whale eats krill that eats plants, both the krill and the whale give nutrients back into the system. Sort of natural fertilizer, if you will. In agriculture, a lot of attention is paid to where's the fertilizer going to come from? Well, in the ocean, it comes from the creatures who live there, who constantly give back. But there's no excess. There's no fat in these systems just waiting for humans to extract. It's a tightly wound system that if it looks like there's an excess, it's like an insurance policy against the next wave of new predation or disease or storms or whatever. And we haven't taken that into account. We didn't with whales. Whales were just there to be consumed. We did a really good job over a few hundred years of consuming whales as commodities. It's only late in the 20th century. And if you go down to the White House today in the afternoon, there's going to be a full-size blue whale celebrating our new attitude about whales. It's not just that they're mammals. It's that, you know, these are wild animals that we can empathize with and maybe see the ocean through their eyes and maybe see ourselves through their eyes in the process. It was not until 1986 that the commercial taking of whales, wild whales, came into effect. And, I mean, there are a few nations that still kill whales. But the bigger problem today is virtually every coastal nation kills wildlife from the sea the way we used to kill birds and whales and seals and whatever else we could get our hands on. It's not just what we take out, it's also what we destroy in the process. The price of trawling is enormous. The price of shrimp, yum yum shrimp, it's enormous. The bycatch and the habitat destruction in taking wild shrimp, nobody thought about in 1961 or even as recently as 1991 or even 2001 around most of the world. We don't think about it. It's just there. It's free for the taking. Let's go get it. Let's feed people. But actually, shrimp, think about it. How many starving people are being fed shrimp. You see popcorn shrimp and red lobster, you see all the shrimp you can eat, but it's pricey food when you come down to it. Krill, wild animals, in the 1980s, we thought we'd kind of fix things by making up for the loss of whales by taking what seemed to be excess krill. There had to be excess krill, right? Because we had fewer whales than did exist before. But what we didn't think about is that, yes, whales that eat krill were depleted, but that was a boon for everything else in the southern oceans that also eat krill. It's not just a straight line. There was no real excess of krill. The wonderful thing about healthy oceans is that they are resilient. The depletion of one piece means good news for somebody else for a while until they slip into oblivion for one reason or another. What we're beginning to understand as savvy five-year-olds is that we really don't understand or appreciate how these systems function, but we do know we can disrupt them. We can destabilize systems that have been developing over hundreds of millions of years. And we have been destabilizing them by moving inexorably across the land and now into the sea, taking at a level that none of these natural systems has ever experienced in all of their history. The fleets that now travel to Antarctica, to the Southern Ocean, to take krill, not to feed people directly. Not a penny that is expended on the fuel and all the rest goes to feed people directly, but it does feed people in the sense that these little krill creatures are squeezed of the oil that does go as a nutrient. And it's an intermediary. Krill are ground up and fed to cows, chickens, and pigs. So they do feed people indirectly, just the way many other fish in the sea are now taken to feed the animals that many of them are not natural carnivores. That we insist that they eat other animals by putting it in their only food supply. They're natural grazers. You know, cows, if they had their way, would eat grass. And they'd get a few bugs in the process, so they're partly, you know, omnivorous. But, oh, we tilt the scales in a drastic way by taking large quantities of ocean wildlife to feed to domesticated animals. And the cost is not really accounted for in terms of what's it costing the ecosystems to take that much krill. We're talking thousands of tons. Or in a global sense, what we're taking the wildlife out of the sea to feed cultivated fish. I mean, aquaculture, another whole topic and an important one and a growing one, maybe the solution to, in many ways, how are we going to feed people going forward if you choose the right animals or plants to grow. And we haven't been doing a very good job on that front either. Growing shrimp could be a partial solution, but not the way we have chosen to do it so far. Wildlife. Sharks. They're the way beyond the equivalent of lions and tigers in the sea. Because when you think about it, lions and tigers, what do they eat? They eat grazers. What do sharks eat? They eat fish. They eat other fish. They eat other fish. They eat other fish. And pretty soon you get down to the little guys. So it takes thousands of pounds of plants at the bottom of a long and twisted food chain to make a pound, let's say a 10-year-old shark, and sharks can be 50 years old by the time they're hauled out of the ocean. We used to think the only good shark was a dead shark. That's what I was told when I started diving. Watch out for the sharks, there are man-eaters out there. But it's humans now doing a really good job of eating sharks. Oops, we're stuck on a place. Let me try it this way. Let's see. Is there I push help, does that help? Oh, there we go.
Okay.
So sharks, perhaps if they ever thought about where they are in the food chain, thought of themselves as top predators, but we're the top predators, obviously, on the ocean as a whole. Nothing compares with humans as the top predators in the sea. And most of our predation on sharks has come about since about the 1980s. NOAA actually fostered a program of trying to develop markets for underutilized species to connect U.S. fishermen with Asian markets, because there's a taste there for shark and shark fins. Oh, we've done such a good job. It wasn't just that, the prosperity now in Asian countries where it's the, you know, really a delicacy. But this is not feeding people. It might feed people in terms of countries that are now looking to sharks as a source of revenue. It feeds their economy, but it's not feeding them directly. And the price we're paying, the price the ocean is paying, the price that our life support system is paying, is enormous. We just haven't been accounting for that. When you take the big predators out of the ocean, sharks, swordfish, tunas, the dolphins, whatever, these creatures that historically are part of the processing system, nutrients going back into the ocean in a form that the phytoplankton can use directly to keep the system rolling, well, we've disrupted it. And we don't think, when you have a tuna fish sandwich or sushi or sashimi, about the real cost or what is taken out of the ocean, the hole that's left in the ocean that may never be filled, considering the numbers now that, you know, when I was chief scientist at NOAA, a little piece of paper came across my desk saying that bluefin tuna in the North Atlantic had been depleted by 90% since 1970. This was 1990, 20 years to knock off 90% of the bluefins using techniques that didn't exist in 1970, but we began to use aircraft and nets and spotter planes and new navigation techniques and sonars. And, well, here we are. Will there be bluefin tuna by the middle of this century? Well, tunas generally. It's a family of about 60 variations on the theme of scombroid fish. All of them taste good, to their detriment from our standpoint. They're all regarded as food. Getting to them is relatively new. In even coastal communities, we couldn't get out far at sea, could not intercept them on their great migration routes. Now we can. I mean, we could, if we really tried, take every last tuna, just as we could if we tried take every last whale. We've done a pretty good job of doing both. With whales, you can still go to the Tokyo Fish Market or Iceland, Norway, and dine on whale. But now we know, and that knowledge ironically comes from fossil fuels. We've burned through a lot of it in half a century, and it's given us so much that we now value. Fertilizers, plastics, knowledge. Probably the greatest gift, the greatest value of having burned through those assets, non-renewable assets, that now we can see ourselves in ways that no humans could before. And, well, this just graphically illustrates what we started talking about when we began this meeting, that when my father came along in 1900, they were well past the billion mark that marked 1800, and we were shy of the 4 billion number that came about in 1980. And this is just a guess. How far is it going to go? Is there a point where it's not going to continue to increase because we have disrupted our life support system, disrupted our food supplies, disrupted the water system, the air we breathe, and all of that? Nice to talk about here on Earth Day, but it's the reality. You know, we are seeing ourselves, seeing the future with new eyes. And it isn't just the biologists. It isn't just the whale huggers of the world. It isn't just those who are concerned about conservation. I attended the first meeting that The Economist had in Singapore about the ocean, and the most recent one in San Francisco in February this year, that looking at the world with new eyes. Yes, the economy, we now see, is, as Tim Wirth once said, a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. You got to take care of the assets in order for there to be an economy. So I know AID is mostly and rightly focused on terrestrial issues, on feeding people by harnessing the land and a handful of plants that do the heavy lifting in terms of calories, whether it's animal calories or plant calories, whether it's carbohydrates, fats, or proteins. Most of it comes from agriculture. And one of the things that we've learned, one of the many things, is that we can do better, that we have to change our ways in terms of agriculture. As we'd learn, if we can take what we now know and adjust our policies to be more in keeping with what we know, we likely can feed at least the same number of people that we now have without stressing the system as much as we currently are. So where does the ocean come into this? And is it just food that we should be focusing on? What about forests as carbon sinks, as oxygen generators? Well, we're beginning to get that on the land. Carbon credits for rainforests. We haven't gotten very far with that, but at least it's an idea that's beginning to take hold. And now it's really new information, and so we should be incorporating this into our policies. Mangroves, as it turns out, are about 50 times more effective in terms of taking up carbon dioxide and storing it, sequestering it in their aquatic roots, generating oxygen, sequestering, capturing and sequestering carbon, and providing habitats for lots of little guys as nursery areas in that network of roots. And yet, to cultivate shrimp, we trade off these valuable forests of mangroves. We've lost more than half of the mangroves for coastal conversion to whether it's shrimp farms or fish farms or parking lots, whatever, condominiums. We haven't really valued our life support system or the contributors that make the planet function. But we're getting there. Seagrass meadows, well, these prosper in shallow water, and they're just the ideal place to take and turn into parking lots in coastal areas. Dredge and fill, dredge and fill. I saw it in my childhood in Florida, where Tampa Bay has been reduced by about 20% because the once productive generating oxygen, taking up carbon, habitat for lots of creatures from clams to larval fish, that they're gone. And in the process, the water has become murky. I went to high school in Clearwater, Florida, when Clearwater had clear water. Isn't that way anymore. So, just a moment to salute the creatures that contribute one in every five breaths you take. We didn't know their existence until 1985, about the same time that we just started to commercially put a moratorium on the killing of commercial killing of whales. So what you see here in this blobby image is one image that was sent to me by Sally Chisholm from MIT. She and her colleagues discovered in an expedition out near Bermuda the existence of Prochlorococcus, not a word that most administrators or politicians have begun to pronounce, but maybe that will change as we realize how important they are. Food production, oxygen generation, and we didn't know they existed until 1985. Now, with changing chemistry of the ocean, what's that going to do to our source of oxygen, the source of food, nutrients? They begin at the bottom of the food chain. They feed the little guys that feed the bigger guys. They feed the little fish that become big fish that also are food for the next level. You know, in agriculture, farm animals, they eat low on the food chain, except when we tip the scales away from that by putting wild animals into their food. Fish, I'm talking about, of course. But out in the ocean, you know, even big animals can feed low on the food chain, but low on the food chain is a relative thing. You think about a jellyfish, that's like a tiger, because they eat animals. Tigers eat animals that graze. So do jellyfish. Huh. And when you think about some of the other fish, oh, that's why it's happening. I see what I'm doing. Sorry. The little fish eat small animals that eat the plants. It's true with squid. And the bigger fish and whales, dolphins, eat the small fish. Food chains in the ocean are just different from those on the land. The principles are exactly the same. It starts with sunlight, goes through photosynthesizers, goes to animals, and then on from there. But in the ocean, most of the fish that we consume aren't taken when they're a year old. Most of the animals we consume are a year or two old. We don't access the plants in the sea, but on the land, we eat mostly plants as a source of most of our calories. So when I hear food security in the ocean, and I hear people justifying the continued large-scale taking of things like tuna, I just have to wonder, what are we really thinking? Now we can see with new eyes where we are. Now, I'm just going to quickly zap through a few images to show you where I'm coming from as somebody who spent a lot of time looking at the world from the standpoint of the fish. Well, starting when I was a little kid with a face mask in Florida, then ultimately harnessing some of the cool new technologies that make it possible to go below where plants live. We have a space station in the sky. We have a space station underwater. I was there most recently in 2012, and I've lived underwater now 10 times, using the ocean as the laboratory. It's possible, with that perspective, to think differently about and see food chains in action, to wonder, where is it going from here? The first time that Aquarius, this underwater laboratory, was established and I had a chance to use it was 20 years ago. Well, 22 years ago. That reef has changed enormously in 22 years. We've seen a depletion of the fish in many parts of the world, but in places where fish have been protected, it's a small part of the planet, there is the chance for recovery. Can we take care of enough of the ocean to have enough fish? Can we reach that magical point that everybody is sort of zeroing in on? Sustainable extraction of wildlife from the sea. If we just take care and manage ourselves, manage the fish, then maybe we can extract a meaningful amount of food from the sea. It was the vision going back to the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and it's still the vision of the World Bank, and I think it's still the vision of AID, both through cultivating a handful of particularly appropriate species that are low on the food chain, fast-growing, and taste good, or even for products such as the phytoplankton that is grown for oil, cultivated in closed systems that can be an alternative to krill oil or menhaden or other fish oil. Good news for the fish if we can get ourselves together to think about alternatives. You see, most people think of fish as something to eat, but I've had thousands of hours getting to know fish on a different basis. Like birds, they have a place in the ocean that transcends pounds of meat or buckets of oil. And the systems of which they are a part, the earth system of which we're a part, it all ties together. What we do to them, we do to ourselves. We have to put them on the balance sheet is something more than pounds of meat. Their role in keeping the planet, a planet that works in our favor, has to be there, right along with maybe some small amount relative to what we have set our goals on that we can take for food. But food for what? To serve a luxury taste? That's where most of the trouble comes from, industrial-scale fishing, with destructive means of extraction, trawling, or gill netting, or long lines that take whatever is there and leave a path of destruction behind. It's not selective what we take from the sea. New values, new understanding of the importance of having intact systems, protecting the biodiversity, the engine that keeps us alive. All these creatures, we're just beginning to realize the diversity, the numbers. The Census of Marine Life came up with a figure of something like 250,000 kinds of creatures live in the sea, all the plants, all the squids, even in the deep sea where photosynthesis doesn't take place, but chemosynthesis is an alternative to producing food from the chemicals that are available in the absence of sunlight. We're just beginning to understand the role of microbes that power much of the way the world works. Just getting to the point where the technology to go into the sea mirrors the technology that takes us up in the sky or enables us to go around the planet on the land. I mean, there are literally billions of cars have been developed, but how many submarines in the course of the last 50 years? A few. How many exist who can go to half the ocean's depth? Half the ocean's depth. About six. And about six countries have them. Well, five. Russia, the U.S., well, maybe with Alvin. Here's the Russian sub. This is the Shinkai 6500. That's Japan's. China. The Sea Dragon goes to 7,000 meters. They can get down to where the lost Malaysian aircraft is believed to be. This is the Sea Dragon. We're just beginning to have access so that, you know, I love the idea of making it possible to have Hertz Renasub or whatever it takes so that any of us, not just a handful of military types or scientists, have the privilege of going into the sea, but to get systems so easy to drive that even a scientist can do it. Even, you know, kids can take rides. And it is possible. New systems are on the horizon. We're in the time, I think, of the greatest era of exploration of the planet. It's just beginning. And it's happened on our watch. The Trieste went to the deepest part of the ocean the year before AID was formed. But it took 52 years before somebody got back to that depth again, the deepest part of the ocean. To understand the ocean, to see what it's like, to report back to us. And it took, well, he is kind of a scientist, Jim Cameron, but he's an artist. He's a polymath. He's a filmmaker, for heaven's sakes, with Avatar and Terminator and a few other blockbuster films to his credit. But he's an explorer, fellow explorer in residence at the National Geographic, who gave us new insights, new reasons to look at the ocean, to realize, as I said at the Economist Forum in San Francisco a few weeks ago, that the most important thing that we extract from the ocean, it's not oil, it's not gas, it's not krill, it's not shrimp, it's not whatever, fish. It's our existence. We have to put that as our highest priority to protect the systems that yield our existence. We have begun to carve up the ocean. It's also happened in the same remarkable period of time that some of us share. 1982, Law of the Sea, exclusive economic zones, half the world beyond that, the high seas. Some look at this as an opportunity for the great fish grab. We had the land grab that preceded much of what we now inherit on the land. In the ocean, it's free, right? The high seas, no nation owns the high seas, all of us do. It's the ultimate global commons, right along with the air we breathe. This is the time, right now, and AID, being an internationally focused organization, has got to be a big part of being smart about how we go forward with carving up the ocean. We will. But can we do it with intelligence? Can we do it with protecting the assets in mind, with the realities in mind, most importantly, the unknown surprise in mind, those black swans that exist that we didn't know what we didn't know when we made some of the policies that currently govern our behavior. We've only protected, well, less than 3%, 2.2. These are the areas that have some form of real protection. A fraction of 1% is fully protected. And there are areas now of considerable interest, like the Arctic, that is up for grabs. What are we going to do? Fish, that's a big deal. What are we going to do about the living creatures that heretofore have been inaccessible? As we lose the ice, we gain access. Bad news for polar bears, good news for shipping, and what about the Sargasso Sea? Just this spring in Bermuda, nations began to come together, five signed, including the United States, to really take action to protect this big area where there's a forest, but it is not anchored in dirt, it's anchored in water. It's the floating golden rainforest, the Sargasso Sea, generating oxygen, taking up carbon, providing habitat, but at risk through what we are doing. Good news, and here's the grand finale. By protecting the ocean, big pieces of the ocean, and fishing perhaps, and conducting aquaculture perhaps in a relatively small part of the ocean, we might be able to get away with increasing the capacity of the ocean to feed humans without degrading the system, our life support system. But we have to be smart. Right now, it's the other way around. We protect a tiny piece of the ocean, and we fish everywhere, and we're suggesting that we could conduct aquaculture anywhere in our life support system. I hope that maybe in the comments that we have today, we have a chance to think about these issues. We don't really have answers yet, but at least to know that we are able, as the only creatures on the planet, to celebrate Prochlorococcus. I don't think the fish know what they're eating. They just go for it. And now there are kids coming along who are protecting sharks. We're looking at the mammals and other creatures with new eyes. Even jellyfish. If you're a five-year-old, you don't see them as a hazard. You don't see them as food. You see them as, incredible creatures. We need new eyes to look at ourselves the way only humans can. I studied this bird, a 62-year-old albatross, 2 years ago when I had a chance to go to Midway. And I thought, you know, her future and all the birds that follow can't know what humans know, and her future is totally dependent on what we do or don't do. And, you know, she's 62 years old, and every year or so, there sometimes skips a year, but new chicks coming along, but they don't know either. It's really our offspring that have the choices to make. On our watch, we need to think more like five-year-olds. Thank you.